you know, like, don't swing for the fences. I mean, look, I was in my, you know, I'm in my mid 50s. I know I don't look it, right? But I probably look like I'm 70, actually. But seriously, I realized I spent a lot of my life swinging for the fences, trying to hit that next home run. And you know what? I call that entrepreneurial investing now. It's great to be an entrepreneur. It's great to try new things. It's great to be Elon Musk, pushing the boundaries of what's possible. But man, I don't want to invest that way. Jeff, who was it? Somebody asked Warren Buffett. Jeff Bezos asked Warren Buffett. He said, hey, why doesn't everybody just copy your investing? It's not that hard to understand. And Buffett reportedly laughed and said, no, nobody wants to get wealthy that slow.
Welcome to the Prosperity Through Multifamily Real Estate Investing podcast, brought to you by Blue Oak Capital. If you are looking to take your real estate investing to the next level and learn how you can achieve your financial success by investing in multifamily real estate, then this show is for you. Our mission is to help you improve your education and learn proven strategies from industry leaders to help you master multifamily investing. Now here's your hosts, Cody Laughlin, John Beatty, and Brian Alfaro.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to the Prosperity Through Multifamily Real Estate Investing podcast. As always, I'm your host, Real Estate Cody, and joining me today is Crypto John.
Oh, man.
And yes, we have reached the point in our social status where we have cheesy nicknames, but I don't care. We're rolling with it.
Wait, John, what am I called?
We're going to figure that out by the end of the show,
well,
Paul.
Yeah, we'll give you a handle by the end of the show, Paul.
Sorry, I forgot you hadn't introduced me yet. Never mind.
No, it's okay.
Go back to my...
I am actually... We do have an illustrious guest on who I will introduce. Paul Moore is with us. He's a founding managing partner at Wellings Capital. Paul started out kind of like me, an engineer, MBA, started in big business. Then he departed to go out on his own and go through kind of a staffing business. Sold that, and then he got into real estate. Started in residential, moved into commercial real estate. Now he's solely focused on private equity and commercial real estate. And he's got a great background. We're going to love to hear more about you, Paul. So with that, welcome, Paul. We appreciate you coming out today.
It's great to be here, but Crypto John? Wait, what is it? Crypto Cody? What is this?
No. It's Real Estate Cody because Cody is 100% real estate. And I just happened to get into crypto and scale up a large portfolio in the past 8 months.
So why are you here? Why are you not on the beach in the Caribbean?
You got to sell first, Paul.
Oh, okay. You got to sell. That's right. It's that little pesky. Yeah. But you can't sell when it's going up like it is, right?
Yeah. You've got to scale out. You've got to scale top. This is a whole nother episode because talking about portfolio diversification is extremely important when you're talking about this because people get over-concentrated in asset class.
They sure do. I know I did.
Yep. And real estate is an excellent diversifier, which I'm sure we'll talk about a little bit today.
Yeah. No kidding, man. I used to dump, like when I sold my company about 23 years ago, I thought I'm an investor now, but actually I was a full-time speculator is what I was. And I would dump everything I could get my hands on as far as money, man. I sold a lamp once, you know? Okay. So seriously, and I would just throw it into that one thing. And you know, if you keep playing double or nothing with all of your assets, you're going to land on nothing at some point. And then what will you have left to double?
Nothing. Very good point. Very, very good point. So, which kind of leads us into, tell us a little bit more about your background, Paul. I'd love to learn more about how you kind of discovered that throughout your investing career.
Yeah, I had an engineering degree, then an MBA, went to Ford Motor Company for 5 years. And I just don't think I was a fit for corporate America, even though I really loved Ford. Then I had my own staffing firm with a business partner for 5 or 6 years. We sold that to a public firm, moved to the Blue Ridge Mountains of Virginia, and eventually started flipping houses. Went from flipping houses to flipping waterfront lots at a beautiful resort called Smith Mountain Lake. Went from that to building houses. And I was always trying to figure out how to get involved in commercial real estate. Syndication was a thing, but it wasn't very famous back in like the early 2000s. Well, I finally landed on we made an oil and gas investment, another one of those double or nothing deals in North Dakota. And while we were there, we realized there were 18 or 19,000 job openings. And a lot of the reason they couldn't be filled is there was no housing. People had to live in their truck or they had to sleep, you know, in these horrible situations. And I mean, we're talking a town of 3,000 people that now had 10,000 guests in it, literally, that Watford City, North Dakota. And so we quickly, and I mean very quickly, built a multifamily facility. It was based on modular, you know, cabins. And then we built another one next door to that. And then we eventually built a Hyatt Hotel. And that's how I landed in commercial real estate. That's my quick background.
That's really cool. I like the evolution of that. And it's really unique because as entrepreneurs, that's what we do, right? You find problems and you go fix it. And
yeah, you had to solve the shale boom problem, right? North Dakota had zero infrastructure to house its workers.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah, we helped a little with that. And what I wanted to do with that is we wanted to create like these beautiful, like, you know, something that would be as nice as someone's home, but a little mini version of it. I mean, we did granite countertops and all this beautiful, but they were only 300 square feet and they were renting for $4,000 a month for basically a hotel room. And if you think of it as a hotel room, $129 a night isn't bad. If you think of it as an apartment, $4,000 a month is outrageous, but that's what we got.
That's awesome. That's cool. What happened after that?
The beauty of supply and demand.
Yeah, yeah. It really is. After that, so the Hyatt Hotel was a disaster, to be honest. My friend did it. It was going to be his retirement. He had sold 5 or 6 companies over a decade, and it was just very, very painful ending. So I decided I wanted to stay in multifamily anyway. So I went back and got in a multifamily mentoring program where I learned so much. Guys, you won't believe this. This is a true story. We were at the end of owning this multifamily quasi hotel. This was years after operating it. I was the asset manager. There's a long story there. But when we were selling it, somebody asked us for the rent roll. And I said, "What's a rent roll?" Anyway. So I thought, man, I should get some training in multifamily. So, you know, a year and a half later, after getting this training and this incredible mentoring that I went through, I actually was able to write a book on multifamily. And I had way more knowledge than I had experience at that point. And I wrote a book about it that's still selling today, 4 years later, 5 years later. And then I, you know, we launched a multifamily syndication firm at that point. That was in around 2014.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, kudos for surviving, you know, that that first experience. You know, it sounds like it was kind of a little bit of luck there, maybe some timing in the market, maybe kind of helped you carry through for sure, you know, but luckily you made it out. But
so actually, that's a good point. I do want to bring up that point. You said your friend was, you know, he was going to treat the Hyatt as a retirement scheme. Was that an overloaded portfolio position?
Oh my goodness. It was so overloaded. I mean, we're talking, he was a pastor of a church part-time and he shut that down. He had 2 or 3 companies he shut down. We sold the multifamily. He took all that money from everything. The church didn't have any money, but I mean, he just focused everything into this one grand slam home run, where he was going to be able to make, you know, let's say, I mean, I don't know how much it would have produced, but let's just say $1 million a year profit it should have produced. And instead it led to, he wasn't actually bankrupt, but because it was a non-recourse loan. I mean, think about this. Not only was he focusing it all there, he was focusing on a city that was too small, probably for most Hyatt hotels. It was Minot, North Dakota. He actually built on the leading edge of town, meaning he was actually the first commercial thing in that area with this thought that a Walmart was coming in, a hospital was coming in across the street. That stuff didn't materialize as soon as we thought. In addition to that, he was banking on oil prices staying at $110 a barrel and they dropped to 30. That was the killer. There was much more that went wrong, but that's some summary of it. And I don't think he would ever do that again. I mean, I think he learned his lesson. He actually,
what lessons did you take away?
You know, like don't swing for the fences. I mean, look, I was in my, you know, I'm in my mid 50s. I know I don't look it, right? But I probably look like I'm 70 actually. But seriously, I realized I spent a lot of my life swinging for the fences, trying to hit that next home run. And you know what? I call that entrepreneurial investing now. It's great to be an entrepreneur. It's great to try new things. It's great to be Elon Musk pushing the boundaries of what's possible. But man, I don't want to invest that way. Jeff, who was it? Somebody asked Warren Buffett. Jeff Bezos asked Warren Buffett. He said, "Hey, why doesn't everybody just copy your investing? It's not that hard to understand." And Buffett reportedly laughed and said, no, nobody wants to get wealthy that slow. Well, like, you know, 19, 20% compounded return over, you know, since 1964 to now, that's slow compared for, you know, somebody who would like to double their money every year, like in crypto or something. Oh, sorry, John. But seriously.
Yeah, no, you're exactly right. People are shooting for 5X returns in like a week.
I know. And so ridiculous. Entrepreneurs often go broke when they invest like the entrepreneur. I guess that's the lesson for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, what's interesting is in this digital age, particularly, like, we have so much accessibility to information at our fingertips, where I feel like it's a good thing and a bad thing, right? It's good because you can expand your network. You can really accelerate your business. But at the same time, What's unfortunate about that is you have a lot of these programs out there. You have a lot of these quote unquote gurus out there that are out there, and you hear the allure of real estate entrepreneurship, right? You hear like how many people have made millions of dollars and their financial freedom and all these taglines that draw people in. But when they get in, after a few months or however long, they realize that it really is a hard business. And to your point earlier about, you know, yeah, it's cool to go be the Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos and stuff, but I mean, it really takes a very special mindset and tolerance to perseverance, I'll say, because I mean, it's a hard road. Let's be honest. I mean, it is a hard road. So I think to your point, you know, when you get in this space, you have to understand that it's a long-term game. It doesn't happen overnight, and you've got to pace yourself or you'll burn yourself out before you ever find any momentum.
It's very true. You know, and my friend, and I'm not going to knock him. I'm going to knock myself. I mean, just like when I had all that money at 33 years old, and I thought, man, I'm just going to find something and plow money. Nobody really, I shouldn't say nobody told me, because that makes it sound like I'm blaming the world. I'm blaming myself. I did not go out and get the knowledge and the education I need. And I poo-pooed it because, you know, like, I don't know how old you are, and I don't want to, you know, I don't want to insult anybody in their 30s, Cody, because it was me. I was the one. The knowledge was out there. I mean, Warren Buffett had that knowledge. He was teaching it. Warren Buffett's mentor, you know, Benjamin Graham, he taught that stuff 100 years ago. So the knowledge was there. I chose to ignore that good knowledge. And I ended up, you know, going from $1.8 million in the bank one decade later to $2.5 million in debt. And so, man, I made a lot of mistakes. But I tell you what, I can now see the providential path of my life, that all those mistakes have led to so much good outcome now. They say mistakes can make you bitter or they can make you better. And I think for me, I've, you know, been able to reap a lot of good from all the mistakes I've made.
Well, I tell you what, Paul, that's why I'm really excited to have you on today, because when I got introduced to your background and your biography, in that biography, it mentions those exact points. And I think for us, like, you know, it's great to hear the success stories, but to me, it's more impactful to hear stories like yours, where, you know, you went from being on top of the mountain, so to speak, and then you got knocked down really, really far, but then you had to pick yourself up. But like you said, you've learned so many valuable lessons through those experiences that have now made you a better entrepreneur, better investor, better individual today. And I know for me personally, I share my story. I've kind of gone through some similar mistakes that have been very expensive mistakes that, you know, looking back is like, God, dummy, you should have never did that. But again, if I never went through those experiences, I couldn't have taken away certain of those things that apply to my business today that I feel like is very beneficial to us now. So I really want to kind of dive into more of that. Kind of tell us about that story of, you know, kind of being on the top, making it to the bottom, and how you clawed your way back.
Yeah, it's actually a very personal story, but I couldn't be honest without telling it accurately. What happened is I kept swinging for the fences. Now, I want to be clear, the $2.5 million in debt was all against real estate. That's including my personal home, my vacation home, a bunch of waterfront lots, some, you know, things like that. It all had tangible value. I'm not talking, it wasn't like I, you know, maxed out a Visa card or $100,000 or something like that, thankfully. So we were in, it was 2007. It was the fall of 2007. And we had no idea of the pit we were about to go into as a nation economically and worldwide, and especially in the real estate realm. We were hoping that the little bumps we had seen in 2006 and seven were the worst of it. Of course, there's a lot of people out there, including a cover of a magazine, said, you know, the real estate empire is about to crumble or something. I can't remember the exact title, but there was a lot of evidence that things were going to crash. Well, my business partner came to me, this is a different guy, about that time and said, man, I can't keep making half of these interest payments on all this debt. I'm signing all the properties and the debt over to you. And we're still good friends to this day, but man, it was really painful. So I had all that debt and I actually had this super confidence. I literally don't remember, Cody, losing 1 minute sleep over this. And I probably should have, but at any rate, I just had this confidence it was all going to work out. Well, I came to this conclusion that I wanted to be like George Mueller. George Mueller is one of my personal heroes. He was a hellion in Germany in the early 1800s, and he became, quote, a saint in England all through the 1800s. He ended up housing a total over a century of 10,000 orphans. And he did this all without ever doing a marketing campaign. He never did a fundraising letter. He actually had these radical views on, man, we don't want to ask for funds. The money will just come when we do the right thing. And there was a lot of, there's books about what the right thing was for him. But at any rate, I'm like, you know what? I just want to be like him. What would he do right now? And I concluded that what he would do is he would start being more generous than ever. And so I called my family together. I called a couple friends together and I said, hey, we're going to start giving our way out of debt. And that went over really well. And let me tell you, so starting January 1st, 2008, we started giving a pretty difficult sum every single week. We didn't want a month to go by. We wanted a week to go by between giving. And so we were very intentional about giving to our church, giving to different nonprofits we had a vested interest in. And 4 weeks later, Cody, I was in a Subway restaurant and I had what I believe was a somewhat random conversation with a real estate developer. And I told him about this 5-acre waterfront property I had that I couldn't subdivide. Now, he was a very successful real estate developer at the lake. And he's like, yeah, you ought to consider this. And I won't go into what this was, but he said, you should consider using this law. And I said, yeah, I know all about that. I studied that law. That won't work in my situation. He said, well, think about it some more. And like he said something else and a light bulb went off. I went, oh my goodness, wait, I think you're right. I need to check that out. And so I went down and I took my surveyor who was very embarrassed. He's like 65 years old. Like, you know, I was like 42. And I took him down to the planning and zoning department at the county the next day, maybe 2 days later at most. And we laid out this outrageous plan to circumvent their law. We laid it out. And we're like, and the lady just shook her head and she just was like, she had her eyes closed. She's like, you've got to be kidding. And she's like, look, I've worked here for decades and no one has ever come up with such an outrageous law. I mean, way to circumvent the law. And then she smiled and she goes, but you did. And anyway, so she went on to tell us that she fully approved what we were doing. She said, there's no way I can stop you if I wanted to. You found a loophole. And so anyway, 13 months later, after a lot of hard work, selling these waterfront lots in the very middle of the Great Recession and everything else, we actually were completely debt-free.
Wow. Wow. That's crazy.
I even paid off my house.
That's awesome. That's awesome, man. You know, going back to the original part of your story, when you talked about the amount of levered debt that you had, that $2.5 million, even though it was tied to real estate, as you mentioned, that time frame of 2007, I'm sure, you know, that was, like you said, that was on the brink of just absolute utter pain, you know, for the next few years. But what's interesting about that is that when I think about like what we're seeing in today's marketplace, where we're at historically low interest rates, I mean, just there's so much liquidity injected into the capital markets that banks are literally trying to give you money, right? I mean, maxing out loan to value, loan to cost, yeah. You know, you again, historically low interest rates. I find that some people are getting a little advantageous when they're going in and they're doing their underwriting or deal acquisitions. And I'm hoping that people aren't coming into some of these deals over leveraged, you know, and may end up in a very similar position. But, you know, I'm sure you having gone through that experience now, you know, is that something that you're factoring into your business today?
It's so true. I mean, so we are super aware, not only of the loan to value ratio going in, but more importantly, in my mind, to the ongoing debt service coverage ratio. And it would be beyond the scope of the time we have, honestly, to get into the deep dive on this. But I'll say to people, go check out the DSCR. The banks allow you to have a 1.25, maybe 1.3. And that would basically be a 25% margin of safety between your net operating income, not including your debt payment, and divided by the debt payment. So it's the net income divided by the debt payment, 25 to 30% margin of safety. I would argue that while that's okay day one, you better have a plan to get a much, much higher debt service coverage ratio if you want us and many other investors I know who look at this stuff to invest with you. So like the average debt service coverage ratio in our portfolio right now, I don't know what it is to the, you know, right to the number right today, because it changes honestly every month, but it's probably about 2.1 or 2.2. That means there's 110 or 120% margin of safety between the rent collections, basically the net revenue and the debt payments. That's a tremendous pad of safety if things go downhill, and they could.
So let me ask you, Paul, then what would you say to those who are listening to that and be like, well, man, if I underwrite to such a conservative cushion, so to speak, I'll never be able to be competitive in finding a deal. What would be your thoughts on that?
Well, honestly, this is one of the reasons we expanded, Cody, from just doing multifamily into self-storage and mobile home parks. You remember, I don't know if you remember this, but there was a big push by the pork industry in the 90s, I think it was, trying to convince people that pork is the other white meat. Well, I never really bought that, but mobile home parks are the other multifamily. And I came to that conclusion. And so we see a lot of when you can buy an asset, a well-positioned asset from a mom and pop seller, you can do value adds, meaningful value adds, to quickly increase that margin of safety that I call the DSCR. And so we have seen, especially in mobile home parks and self-storage, because there are so many mom and pop sellers, the opportunity to increase that quite quickly. I mean, there's so many examples. I'm just trying to think of, here's one real quick in your state. So we invested in a facility in Beeville, Texas. You probably never heard of Beeville, Texas. It's a small town, but you know where I would never dream of buying a multifamily in a town of 12,000, I think it is. It works, self-storage and mobile home parks work quite well because they're based on a very different dynamic demographically. But anyway, the property was purchased for cash for $2.3 million in March of 2019. By the end of June 2019, the property was appraised after a lot of tinkering was done. I mean, our operating partner went in and did a lot of stuff quickly. I'm not saying it was, you know, underpriced that much. It was actually a fair price when he bought it. But in 4 months, he made so many radical changes that he was actually able, remember, he bought $2.3 million in cash. He got it appraised for $4.6 million just about 4 months later. And so at that point, he put debt on it for the first time. He put on $2 million in debt, which is about, I think it was 43% loan-to-value ratio. And the debt service coverage ratio was immediately over 2.0. That's one example of many. But that happened because it was poorly run. It had the rents were 25% below market, had very high delinquency. It had low occupancy. It had no website, no marketing. This was a self-storage, by the way. It had no U-Haul. They weren't doing U-Haul rentals. When he could add that, you know, in minutes when he took over the property. I mean, I shouldn't say minutes, but within days, he had U-Haul set up, you know? I mean, he was able to dramatically increase the revenue and therefore the net operating income and therefore the appraised value very quickly. And so the debt on it, honestly, when he put, if he'd put $2 million in debt up front, that would have been over leveraged. But $2 million debt 4 months later was a very low, modest leverage. You see what I mean?
Yeah, no, it's a great point. And it's a great analogy and putting that in perspective. I appreciate that. And I want to kind of go back to the beginning of that. You know, in this transition to the self-storage and mobile home parks, you mentioned that the demographic or maybe the market profiles are a little bit different. Does that, do you find that that gives you more advantage and flexibility when it comes to sourcing opportunities? Because right now in multifamily, right? I mean, you know, you're targeting the primary and secondary markets, and you know, there's, you want to be very strategic about the fundamentals that you're targeting.
It's very true. You know, our mentor said he would never buy in a town of less than 500,000. And so like Asheville, North Carolina, which is great market, man, it's like on the small side. Greenville, South Carolina, Greenville, Spartanburg, as amazing as that market is, they only have 800,000, or last I checked, at least in that market, they're growing. So they're, you know, a little bit on the marginal side for where they'd want to buy. This mentor of mine was mainly buying in Dallas, Houston, Austin, places like that. So when we bought in Lexington, Kentucky, that had between 300,000 and 400,000 people, we bought a large multifamily. I tell you, an economic shock to a market like that can really hurt you. But in self-storage, you're looking at the micro demographics of where that facility is located compared to the number of people in a radius. So for example, if, let's just use that example there. If I had 600 or 700 self-storage units in a town that small, you might kind of freak out and say, wait a minute, that's like having a massive, beautiful, large multifamily in a tiny little town. That would be a really bad idea, in my opinion. But in self-storage, there's a demographic that says that the average person in America uses 7 or 8 square feet of self-storage. So if you have 12,000 people in an area, let's say, for example, that's in a 3 mile radius. I don't know that it was. That's 12,000 times 7. I'm not going to do the math in my head very well, but I think that's 84,000 or 96, somewhere in that 90,000 square feet range. Okay. So 12,000 people can support 90,000 square feet of storage. Oh, really? Well, this facility was, say, 60,000 square feet. Well, there was no other self-storage in that 3 mile radius. I'm just saying for an example here, because there may have been in that case. If that's true, then you can locate in a very small town and it works.
Interesting. I know nothing about the self-storage space, so this is really appealing. But you know, what's interesting is I feel like multifamily has been the golden child for the past decade, right? Oh, yeah. Everything's been multifamily. And right now, I mean, it is an absolute headache in this space right now, because you're one of, you know, 30, 40, 50 offers on a deal, especially if you're in those primary, secondary markets. So the level of competition is just, it's incredible. But I kind of feel like self-storage, mobile home parks, over the past few years, that has become very popular as well as an investment strategy. Are you guys finding a lot of competition coming into those spaces as well? And then not only that, to piggyback off that question, the inventory seems to be a little bit less plentiful as well, right? Because some of these markets, you're not just popping up new mobile home parks, for example, here and there. So talk to us a little bit about the competition and the deal flow, so to speak.
Let me start with inventory first. Mobile home parks are the only asset type that we know of that have a decreasing supply and an increasing demand every year. And so that's a unique thing about mobile home parks. We believe there are only about 10 built in the U.S. every year, and there's about 100 to 125 torn down in an average year as well. And so there's a decreasing supply. which make a really unique dynamic. There's 44,000 or so mobile home parks in the U.S., and 85 to 90% are owned by mom and pop owners. And that's the key. The key in that is, well, if 85 to 90% are mobile or mom and pop owners, then whereas 93% of multifamily, 50 units and up, from what I've read, 93% of them are owned by corporations who have already wrung the value out of them. And so it's very, very hard to compete for that 7% that really have a lot of meat on the bones and value add opportunities if that statistic is true. And so mobile homes and self-storage have 54,000 or so units in the U.S. That's the same as all the Starbucks, Subway, and McDonald's combined. I was looking at another statistic with Nike the other day. Anyway, so that's a large number of self-storage facilities. But, you know, where we see the beautiful ones along the highway in Dallas and Houston, there's a lot of mom and pops like that one in Beeville, Texas, that are poorly run, poorly managed, and they're a cash cow to the owner. And those owners have benefited by the fact that the cap rates compressed from, let's say, 12% down to 6% already. Well, they've already doubled the value of their property and they're sitting on this cash cow. They don't have the desire or the willingness or the, you know, the resources to improve that, to bring them up to full value. And so this comes back to a full circle of your question. This guy that inherited this self-storage facility from his parents who passed away and is now making like $30,000 a month doing virtually nothing, he doesn't have the motivation to make it a world-class facility. But when my friend Matt buys that facility and we invest in it, he might be able to get it up to $60,000 a month income within a year, therefore doubling the value of the facility, but quadrupling the equity, the value of the equity, because using 50% leverage just does that. Okay, so it opens up a whole broad range of thousands, and I would even argue potentially tens of thousands of opportunities that you can't get access to in multifamily because it's so overheated. I mean, look, I wrote a book called The Perfect Investment about multifamily, but for me, it wasn't perfect because I didn't have a good acquisition team. I didn't have a good acquisition strategy, and it became an imperfect investment for me because I didn't have the strategy and the team, but also because the market was so overheated and competitive. And so for me, I think that the opportunities to acquire assets with meat on the bone are better right now, at least in self-storage and multifamily or in mobile home parks. But to answer your question, yes, there are a lot of people discovering this, thousands and thousands of people rushing into this space, and it is making it more competitive.
Yeah, I would argue that's probably commercial real estate in general, right? And again, that goes back to our point we were discussing where now in this digital age, information is more readily accessible and you have some of these items that probably were, you know, behind the door conversations probably 5-10 years ago that's now more out in mainstream media, so to speak. And I think people are catching on to the trends, but and it's drawing more people in. But, you know, it goes back to our point we were mentioning at the beginning of the show where diversification is so important. And if you're isolated just to one lane, you could either be very frustrated for a very long time, mm-hmm. or you could find yourself with a high amount of exposure in the event that a correction or downturn in that particular niche occurs. So, you know, as our show, we're talking about this before, you know, we're very, very much centered on multifamily apartment syndication. That's our business model. But our intent for this show is to give the listeners an avenue for education where they can go and make their best educated decision for themselves. I mean, it's
awesome,
you know, and like you, you know, you've been in multifamily, you've had a lot of ups and downs, you've had some success, you've had some distress, but now you've found a niche that pivoted to allot you more opportunities. That's kind of what we want to be able to provide for the show is giving the audience a roundabout exposure to really what's out there at their disposal to allow them to go and expand their portfolio. So, really cool topic here, Paul. Before I want to kind of pivot because we're kind of running out of time in a bit, and I want to kind of touch on a few more points that from your background. But where do you see the space going? Like you said, with the level of competition, you are starting to see some cap rate compression in in those two particular niches. Where do you see the forecast for the self-storage and mobile home park space going forward over the next, let's say, 5 years?
I really think it's going to continue to get compressed. One of the opportunities in this right now is that REITs and other institutional investors are loving the space. And as a result, it's allowing somebody who's a middle-level operator, and I mean, not a mom and pop, but not an institutional, somebody in the middle, to take a whole bunch of mid-sized, poorly run assets and basically franchise them into a beautiful package and then sell at a compressed cap rate, meaning a higher price, to the institutional who's willing to pay 4% cap rate instead of the 6% it was acquired at. So if you can acquire at 6%, meaningfully improve it, I mean, you know, to where it's operating at a much higher cap rate, if you want to call it that. That's probably not the right terminology. But let's say you're getting it at 6%, you get it to where it's operating at 12%, then you sell it at 4%. I mean, if you sit down and do the math on what I just said with leverage, it's an incredible opportunity. I think that opportunity is going to be there for a number of years. But someday, just like the last World War I veteran died when I was younger and there was not one left on the planet, there's going to be very few, if any, left mobile home parks and self-storage mom and pops left someday as well. And we'll have to be looking at some other asset type, won't we?
Yeah, you got to be able to pivot and you know, ride, I guess, with the market, right? And but to that point, where do people go to find out more about, I don't know, demographics, trends in the space? Like, how can they be in tune into some of those drivers that will affect that space?
That's a good question. There's a LinkedIn group on that has like 5,000 members on mobile home park investing. I don't spend a lot of time there. Self-storage, Scott Myers, he's a great trainer. He's very involved on Bigger Pockets. He's based in Indianapolis. Scott Myers has, I think it's selfstorageinvesting.com. Frank Rolfe has, that's R-O-L-F-E. He has mobilehomeuniversity.com. Those would be some places I'd recommend people go. If they want some basic information on self-storage and mobile home park investing, I've got it on my website as well.
Awesome. Awesome. I'm going to make sure all those references are in the show notes. So I appreciate that. Paul, let's make a quick pivot real quick. One thing that we probably didn't, I don't think we discussed it here in the show, but I know offline, we talked a little bit about it. You've kind of switched from syndication to fund structures. And I want to see if you can kind of allude to a little bit of that transition for us for a little bit.
Yeah, when we decided we wanted to, you know, basically expand from multifamily only into self-storage and mobile home park investing, we realized that we did not have a team. We didn't have a track record. We didn't have 10, 20, 30 years of history in self-storage or mobile home parks like some of these guys. And so we thought, you know, we've got 100 and some investors waiting to invest with us. Is it really wise and fair to go to them and say, hey, good news, we're going to transition to these other asset classes. We've never done it before, but they look really good. I just didn't think that was a really good thing to do for us. So we told our investors, look, if you hang with us, we promise we will do a very detailed level of due diligence. We'll go out and find the very best operators, like the 80-20 of the 80-20, if you will, you know, the top 4% if we could find them. And we would do thorough due diligence. We would do all the due diligence they would do if they had the time, if they had the knowledge, if they, you know, were able to fly around the country and look at these different spaces. We would do all that for them so they could focus on their day job. Like, you know, a lot of these are IT professionals, doctors, dentists, retirees, high net worth people who don't have the time or the knowledge to do that. We told them we would be their due diligence partner, and it really resonated with people. And so we did that on a number of individual, just a very small number of individual deals. And then we launched our first fund. And now we have, we just finished our third fund. And our goal with the funds, Cody, is to give people diversification across asset classes, across operators, geographies, individual assets, and even across strategies. Within our funds right now, we have operators who buy, fix up, and sell an asset in as little as a year. And we have other operators who buy and hold for the full 10 years, which is the life of the fund.
I really, really like this fund structure. And we've had a guest on our show, a good friend of ours, Nicholas Moore, who's a real estate attorney that is specializes in these funds of funds. And, you know, it's become more of a popular way of allocating capital to get in deals. And I think to your point, you know, right now, as the level of competition is getting higher and higher in this space, it's getting harder and harder for the newer investor or the less experienced investor to find opportunities. One thing that we always preach is go align with the successful operators, right? Go find a way to add value to them and partner with them. Well, how do you do that? Well, capital speaks a lot of volume right now when it comes to adding value. So I'm really glad we brought this up, because for somebody who's, you know, looking to find a way to partner with these guys, if you can create a similar structure, which you have in the fund and pulling resources together and then going to align with those top of class operators, you know, you could really find a lot of way, a lot of opportunity to find some success in getting your portfolio started. So I appreciate that.
Yeah. I mean, these guys and gals that we invest with are doing stuff that we couldn't even dream of. For example, one of our operators, we had a part-time guy who had a whole lot of other responsibilities. That was our acquisition team when we were doing multifamily. God, I'm here to tell your audience that was a massive, massive mistake. And that was just like, you know, 5 years ago. Well, now I'm working with an operator who has literally 7 people, and it's going toward 10 in a bullpen, in a room, in Nevada. Those 10 people, 7 today going to 10, they're calling 100 to 150 self-storage and mobile home park owners each every day. So wow. They're covering 1,000 or more mom and pop operators per day, 5 days a week, year in and year out. And they're calling every one of these approximately 2 to 4 times a year. So when the 88-year-old guy, they called with a 300 unit mobile home park in Michigan, they called him 7 years ago. Well, they called him quarterly for 1 year, then 2, then 3, then 7. And recently at 95 years old, their niece, the guy's niece calls them. I know how you think the story's going, but, and the niece says, grandpa's here, or my uncle's here. We finally convinced him to sell at 95 years old. Whatever you offered him a couple of years ago, he'll take it. And she said, he goes, wait, you'll take that offer that I made in 2018 or whatever? And she said, yeah, that's more money than he could ever use. We'll take it. And so, I mean, like, you know, that's like an example of persistence. I'm sure that mobile home park owner got a lot of other calls, but who else called him quarterly for 7 years? That's 28 calls, but that works. I'm telling you, that strategy works. I couldn't do that.
Neither. I don't know that I could either, man. That's a lot of patience. But to your point, I mean, that's exactly right. It's the follow up. It's the never, you know, you never give up. And that's kind of where people end up falling off the cliff, so to speak, right? Is they don't give it enough time to prosper and really build up relationships and to let it come back full circle. So, man, we could do a whole nother podcast episode just on that topic alone.
When can we? Let's do it.
Let's do it. We need to book it. We'll get that lined up. But one last pivot before we go, because I want to talk about, you have a book, and let me see here. You have a podcast called How to Lose Money, which is great. And then you also have a book that you've written, and remind me the title again. Forgive me.
The book on multifamily that's on Amazon is The Perfect Investment: Create Enduring Wealth from the Historic Shift to Multifamily Housing.
Yeah. So we want to make sure to reference that in the show note. Definitely want to check that out. But let's talk about your podcast a little bit. I love this title, How to Lose Money. And it's definitely catchy. It definitely grabs your attention. So what was the inspiration behind the podcast? Kind of tell us a little bit about the audience and the message that you're sharing.
Cody, when I would go to these conferences and things over the years, I would hear these wonderful speakers tell their success stories from the stage. And that was all well and good. I get it. It makes sense. But I would notice that the people in the audience would get discouraged. And especially one time after all these success stories for days, and somebody got up and said, hey, would you be willing? It was a panel of these amazing speakers. Would somebody be willing to share your failure stories? I think it would be encouraging for us to know that things weren't always easy for you. And every speaker, literally deer in the headlights, looked at each other and nobody gave an answer. And I was mad. I thought, you just told 500 people that your life was easy, that your success came easy, and you basically discouraged everybody in the audience and made them all think, I'll never make it. And that's exactly what people were saying at lunch and different breakout sessions. People would say, I'll never have that success. I'll never have that connection. That guy's education was better than mine could ever be. I'll never make it. I might as well quit. And so I thought, man, if I ever got on a stage, I would tell the truth. And what I learned was when I got on that stage, all those people have the same problems, same pain, same failures, same losses, same $2.5 million in debt. Well, maybe not that bad as I did. And I, you know what? They made it and they created something beautiful by persevering. And so I thought, if I ever have a podcast, I didn't actually think that way. I said, if I ever get on stage, I would tell the truth. Well, when I got a podcast, I thought, I'm going to tell the truth. And so we've interviewed 238 people about their pain, failures, losses, insecurities, and all that on the road to success. It's been a lot of fun.
That is really, really cool, man. I love that. And I completely agree with you. Again, we talked a little bit about this earlier where, you know, it's great to hear the successes, but where I feel like you really, really get to appreciate other experiences is through other people's challenges and through the lessons that they've learned. And the best lessons that have been learned have come from those mistakes. And I referenced myself. I've made plenty of them. And I used to be embarrassed about speaking to those because you start to worry about, oh, what are people going to think? What if I tell them I made this mistake, this way? What it shows is that you have experience, right? You put yourself out there that you've learned some hard lessons, but if you're doing it right, you're not going to make the same mistake over and over. And again, I just find that resonates so much better when people like you are sharing that message, sharing that story. And, you know, I appreciate that. I'm looking forward to tuning in.
That's awesome, man. Thank you. I appreciate it. I think people have been encouraged when they realize they're not alone in their pain.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, man. I think it makes you relatable for sure. Yeah. Cause it's very easy to look at the Grant Cardones and say, oh yeah, we'll never touch that level of success. But as you mentioned too, that there's no perfect road to reaching that success, and people need to be able to relate, and they need to be able to resonate that. So,
you know, you just brought up something I had not thought of. I've never said this on a podcast, but my son, who's a very successful real estate investor, he's 27. I'm giving him some ideas on dreaming about 10xing his business. You know, literally, like I can see how you could go from the 7 counties you're operating in into 70 counties, or actually 700. And he's so discouraged because he feels like he has to get from 7 to 700 overnight to do what I'm saying. I said, no, you don't. No, you don't. All you have to do is go from 7 to 8, and then 9, and then 10. You're going to grow incrementally. You're not going to be, you know, nationwide overnight. And I think that's really important. And failure is going to happen. It's inevitable. Jeff Bezos from Amazon, he bragged that he wasted billions of dollars failing, and he didn't mind because those experiments helped him become Amazon.
Yeah, that's such a great reference. And you're absolutely right. I mean, it goes back to your point earlier. If you're swinging for the fences every time, I mean, look, it's just going to be a long, long, hard road. There's nothing wrong with just taking your time, pacing yourself, you know, small, consistent, actionable items every day, you know, small increases in your business can make a big difference over the long run. So yeah, man, great, great message there, Paul. So listen, unfortunately, we're getting near the end of our time and it's been a fun conversation, man. Definitely looking forward to having you back on the show for sure to carry it on. But before we go, I've got 4 more questions for you and then we'll wrap up. Okay.
All right.
Awesome. All right, Paul. So tell us, what do you like to do for your continued education to further your own investing?
Yeah. You know, I really like podcasts and audiobooks. But I mean, even being on a podcast like this, that idea I just had, I formulated, that wasn't like a brand new idea that you don't go from, you know, 1 to 10x overnight. But just saying it and interacting with you on that, I just learned something that I'm going to be able to use in our business. So conversations help a lot.
Yeah, I agree with that. What have been some of the lasting lessons you've learned throughout your journey?
Well, the how to lose money thing, I think, is a really good one there. I think it's easier to avoid failure than to replicate success. And that may be oversimplifying a big thing. But I mean, I think if I listen to the 238 lessons we've had on our show, it's easier to avoid doing those wrong things than it is to replicate sometimes to replicate the right things other people have done. I think it's a mix.
Yeah, interesting. What would be some advice you'd give to listeners to help them grow their businesses?
I would actually go back to the beginning of our show where we talked about the difference between investing and speculating. You know, investing is when your principal is generally safe and you've got a chance to make a return. Speculating is when your principal is not at all safe and you've got a chance to make a return. It's okay to speculate. It's probably better over a lifetime to invest more than speculating. The first economist who won the Nobel Peace Prize from the US said, investing should be like watching grass grow or watching paint dry. If you want excitement, take $800 and go to Las Vegas.
I love that, man. That's fantastic. Great advice. I really appreciate that.
Yeah, Paul Samuelson said that. And it's just, to me, that really helped me a lot.
I love that. I may even make that some type of headline for the show, man. That's a good one. I like that. So, all right, Paul, tell the listeners how they can learn more about you, your podcast, your book, and how they can get connected with you.
Yeah, they can get the book on Amazon. I've got another book coming out on self-storage. Bigger Pockets is publishing that late this year, I believe. As far as getting hold of me, you can reach out at wellingscapital.com. That's WELLINGS capital.com.
Awesome. Again, we'll make sure that's in the show notes. Paul, really appreciate the wonderful conversation. I'm looking forward to many more, sir.
Thanks, Cody. I can't wait to be on again if you'll have me.
Oh, absolutely. It's going to happen. All right, Paul. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Today's episode was proudly brought to you by Blue Oak Capital. To learn more about Blue Oak Capital and how you can partner with us, visit www.blueoakinvests.com. Tune in next time.